from deep inside your radio.
How about that, Chris Hall? Chris Paul. Yeah, I'm in New Orleans again, ladies and gentlemen, and obviously by that opening remark, last week on this broadcast, I featured a soundbite of National Security Advisor Stephen Hadley speaking on the importance of quiet diplomacy with the Chinese to deal with the problem of Tibet, except that 8 times during that soundbite, he said Nepal instead of Tibet. That was wacky enough. Then, the next day, the Associated Press, Reuters, and the New York Times all featured a quote from that appearance by Steve Hadley and changed the quote to quote him as saying Tibet, when in fact, as you heard on this broadcast, 8 times he said Nepal. To be fair, the New York Times, at the bottom of its story, said Mr. Hadley did say Nepal 8 times when observers surmised he was intending to say Tibet. Everybody else just changed it and moved along. Now, you know how much attention minor gaffes and press misdeeds can get in this country. And yet this one just went by. It's okay to change the National Security Advisor's repeated misstatement in a quote, put quotes around it, and then walk along. And apparently that's all right. So it's all right with me. If it's all right with you, it's all right with me. Deal? Now, ladies and gentlemen, this will be a program very low in production values. Well, actually, totally lacking in them. No production for many reasons. I'm just going to sit here and yak with you and spin a few tunes. But basically, many reasons. Most of them I can't talk about on the air. But I'm devoting some time and energy to the new record, Songs of the Bushmen, which will be coming out soon. So ignore it, as you normally do. But I have to say, ladies and gentlemen, you know that a great deal of time and attention has been spent this last week on the probably incautious remarks that Barack Obama made at a closed meeting of supporters in San Francisco, in which he said that people in rural Pennsylvania, probably bitter over their the economic downturn the state has experienced over the last few decades, have in their bitterness possibly clung to religion and guns as support, for support. And he's been raked over the coals, including in the recent debate on ABC, as if, here's what I don't understand, as if bitterness is a bad thing. See, you know, without any trace of bitterness, a cup of coffee is just, warm caffeine. Without any bitterness, all chocolate is a Hershey bar. See what I'm saying? It's and speaking as one who knows, bitterness does not make me cling to either guns. And that's a good thing, because most of the people I'd be aiming at, you know, can't run very fast, or religion. It makes me cling, first of all, to myself to make sure I'm still there, and to my loved ones, which I think is what it's supposed to do. And I'm just on the lookout for any more remarks, any more comments from the punditocracy that tend to denigrate bitterness. I would advise against it, because if I hear one more, it's going to make me go nice. And nobody wants that. Hello, welcome to the show. From the banks of Lake Pontchartrain in New Orleans, Louisiana, I'm Harry Shearer, welcoming you to this edition of the show. Ladies and gentlemen, it was about a week or so ago that ABC News came out with a story that the lead of which was, in dozens of top secret talks and meetings in the White House, the most senior Bush administration officials discussed and approved specific details of how high-value suspects would be interrogated by the CIA. The so-called principals who participated in the meetings also approved of the use of combined interrogation techniques on terrorist suspects who proved difficult to break. A handful of top advisors signed off on how the CIA would interrogate top al-Qaeda suspects, whether they would be slapped, pushed, deprived of sleep, or subjected to waterboarding. So it's not the bad apples. It's the whole tree, ladies and gentlemen, was the gist of that story, which you know how much attention that got. It's just the top officials of the United States government, Dick Cheney, Condi, Rummy, approved what was being done at Guantanamo, which migrated to Abu Ghraib, which was blamed on bad apples. But wait, there's more. In news from outside the bubble. Oh, it's a parade of copyrighted features today. From the Guardian newspaper in London, America's most senior general was hoodwinked by top Bush administration officials determined to push through aggressive interrogation techniques of suspects held at Gitmo, leading to the U.S. military abandoning its age-old ban on the cruel and inhumane treatment of prisoners. General Richard Myers, chairman of the U.S. Joint Chiefs of Staff from 2001 to 2005, wrongly believed that inmates at Guantanamo and other prisons were protected by the Geneva Conventions and from abuse tantamount to torture. The way he was duped by senior officials in Washington who believed the Geneva Conventions and other traditional safeguards were out of date is disclosed in a devastating account of their role, extracts of which appear in a new book, Torture Team. Philippe Sands, professor of law at University College London, reveals that senior Bush administration figures pushed through previously outlawed measures with the aid of inexperienced military officials at Gitmo. Myers believes he was a victim of intrigue by top lawyers at the Department of Justice, the office of Cheney, and at Donald Rumsfeld's Defense Department. And the Gitmo lawyers charged with devising interrogation techniques were inspired by the exploits of Jack Bauer in the TV series 24. And Myers wrongly believed that interrogation techniques were those specified in the Army's field manual. The lawyers, all political appointees who pushed through the interrogation techniques, were Alberto Gonzalez, David Addington, chief of staff now of Vice President Cheney, and William Haynes. Also involved were Doug Feith, Rumsfeld's undersecretary for policy, and John Yoo. Who is Yoo? Myers mistakenly believed, Myers, the Joint Chief of Staff, he was the one official who did not understand the implications of what was being done. Sands, who spent 3 hours with the former general, says he, the general, was confused about the decisions that were taken. Myers mistakenly believed the new techniques recommended by William Haynes, chief lawyer in the Defense Department, and authorized by Rumsfeld in December 2002 for use by the military at Guantanamo, had been taken from the U.S. Army field manual. They included hooding, sensory deprivation, and physical and mental abuse. Sands writes, quote, "As we worked through the list of techniques, former Joint Chief of Staff Chairman Myers became increasingly hesitant and troubled. Haynes and Rumsfeld had been able to run rings around him," unquote. Myers and his closest advisors were cut out of the decision-making process. He didn't know that Bush administration officials were changing the rules, allowing interrogation techniques, including the use of dogs, amounting to torture. Quote, "We never authorized torture. We just didn't. Not what we would do," Myers said. Sands comments, quote, "He really had taken his eye off the ball. He didn't ask too many questions." Larry Wilkerson, former chief of staff to Colin Powell, when he was Secretary of State at the time, says, quote, "I do know that Rumsfeld had neutralized Myers in many significant ways. The secretary did this by cutting Myers out of important communications, meetings, deliberations, and plans." Wilkerson, former chief of staff to Powell, adds in this story, "Haynes, Feith, you, Gonzalez, and Addington should never travel outside the U.S. except perhaps to Saudi Arabia and Israel. They broke the law. They violated their professional ethical code. In the future, some government may build the case necessary to prosecute them in a foreign court or an international court," unquote, Larry Wilkerson. It is an affirmative obligation of any country where a person suspected of war crimes travels to be in a position to prosecute them. That's a fact. Also, outside the bubble, ladies and gentlemen, from the Toronto Globe and Mail. We have to get our news from Canada. And then they get their entertainment from us. It's an even switch. Dateline Durham, North Carolina, the creator of the CIA's program of extraordinary rendition. That's the program whereby suspected terrorists were hooded, chained, put in a plane, flown to Egypt, Syria, some nice place where we had gotten assurances that the prisoner wasn't going to be tortured. The creator of that program says he has always distrusted interrogation intelligence flowing from that practice, given that the admissions it produced were usually, quote, very tainted, unquote, by the foreign agencies who jailed and interrogated suspects at the behest of the United States. Now he tells us. Michael Scheuer, an outspoken anti-terrorism crusader, took part in a Duke University Law School panel this week. There, he revealed his doubts about the program. In Canada, rendition has become synonymous with the process that resulted in Maher Irar from Ottawa spending a year in a Syrian jail where he was beaten with electric cables during the first phases of his captivity. He's a Canadian citizen. Canadian officials have apologized to him. He's a telecommunications engineer and paid him $10 million U.S. Hey, Maher, ask for it in Canadian dollars. They're worth more now. Admitting that he was wrongly smeared in intelligence exchanges emanating from Canada, leading to the U.S. decision to render him. Bush administration is far less contrite in that affair, blocking lawsuits on the grounds that probing rendition would illegally spill state secrets. Scheuer is still a big booster of the program, but now retired, he created it when he was a CIA analyst. He said the program has been enormously valuable, taking high-level terrorists off the streets, even when they turn out to be innocent telecommunications engineers, I guess. But he added that resulting interrogations proved dubious once suspects were sent to third country prisons, which was the point of the program. Quote, "You could bet on the testimony. You could bet on the testimony given you. It was altered in a way that would serve the interests of the country that was giving it. So it was very tainted in the sense that if country X or country Y interrogated these people, you would really have some information, but it would be far from coupled with what was actually being said," unquote, Michael Scheuer. Finally, news from outside the bubble. From the Reuters news service, the Israeli newspaper Ma'ariv this week reported that the leader of the Likud party in Israel, Benjamin Netanyahu, told an audience at Bar Ilan University that the 9/11 terror attacks had been beneficial for Israel. Quote, "We are benefiting from one thing, and that is the attack on the Twin Towers in the Pentagon and the American struggle in Iraq," Ma'ariv quoted the former prime minister saying. Well, those are two things. He reportedly added these events, quote, "swung American public opinion in our favor," unquote. Benjamin Netanyahu. He's not a Netan, but he's not a, no, he's not a Yahoo. News from outside the bubble, ladies and gentlemen. Yes, it is a copyrighted feature of this broadcast. And it's not the only one. Here comes another one right now. Tales of Airport Security. Thank you very much, The Beatles. From Ravi, "Dear Harry, I sat in seat 21B for both my flights to and from Denver. Because 21B is the very last row of the plane, I was able to peek into the galley where the flight crew was preparing snacks and drinks. When I looked back, I saw they were using the emergency exit as a multi-tool. The nearby storage drawers were all extended, blocking access to the door, and they hung a garbage bag from a drawer handle to the latch of the emergency exit. My favorite part is the crew stored a carton of orange juice behind the latch on the emergency exit. As I said, this happened on my flights to and from Denver. I thought about taking a picture of it, but realized it wouldn't be a good idea because, says Ravi, I am brown and it would probably frighten people." Now, that's airplane security, but let's get to airport security. Won't we? Actually, this is airplane security, too, from John. "A little conversation I had with a flight attendant on a recent trip from New York to Miami. On the 2.5-hour flight on Continental to Miami, they actually served a meal of a turkey sandwich to everybody on board. I had actually marked on Expedia that I would like the vegetarian option, since I'm a vegetarian. And though I knew I would not have to have a meal on the flight, I thought, oh, well, might as well mark it. Anyway, when the flight attendant handed me my turkey sandwich, I said very nicely, oh, excuse me, miss, but I actually put in for the vegetarian meal. She said, ever since 9/11, we haven't had those. I said, so because of 9/11, you haven't been able to serve vegetarians? She said, yes. All right, let's get to the airport. My wife brought home an item on a recent trip to North Carolina after a bachelorette spa weekend with her childhood friends. She brought a small memento from the trip for our young daughters in the form of a snow globe from the tiny burg where she stayed in North Carolina. Upon arriving at the security checkpoint at the Charlotte airport, my wife, already running late, hurriedly placed her bags on the belt for screening. The TSA agent screening her bags suddenly stopped the belt and peered into the screen. He then summoned another agent, a young woman, who strolled over to quiz my wife on the contents of her potential contraband. Already annoyed, my wife quickly shared her inventory of a sweater, 3 pieces of fudge, and a snow globe. "Oh," replied the agent, "snow globe." "Snow globe?" asked my wife. The agent then informed my wife that the government would be confiscating the snow globe because it exceeded the 3 ounces of liquid rule. "Are you serious?" asked my wife. "Haven't allowed those in a long time," came the reply, adding, "not even those teeny tiny ones. You could put it in your suitcase, though." Her mouth agape, my wife snapped, "It's on its way to the plane. Can you go and get it for me?" The agents, mouths agape, just stared. My wife's sarcasm lost on them. My daughters, saved from the evil snow globe, were happy to have their mother home, nevertheless. Tales of airport and airplane security, ladies and gentlemen. So very, very copyrighted. If the U.S. wants to stop Iran in its tracks, perhaps it should make sure the country can't buy Department of Defense equipment on eBay. This from New Scientist. Investigators from the GAO wanted to know if it was possible for countries or organizations opposed to the U.S. to obtain sensitive items of military equipment over the Internet. They were astonished to find out it's easy. Using eBay and Craigslist and posing as members of the general public, the team had no trouble at all picking up 10 pieces of U.S. body armor, which is supposed to be destroyed if no longer required. They also managed to buy a used nuclear biological chemical protective suit, an antenna for an F-14 jet fighter, and several other sensitive items. The U.S. has retired its F-14 fleet, but one nation has not. Iran. And it is known to be in need of components to maintain the aircraft. The GAO doesn't know exactly how the sellers of the equipment got hold of it. But a string of military employees and self-employed traders now face criminal investigations. And, you know, it's not just that FEMA put people in trailers and suppressed the reports of the formaldehyde fumes in those trailers being possibly carcinogenic. There's now something else it may cause. Dateline Chicago, exposure to formaldehyde may raise one's risk of getting Lou Gehrig's disease, U.S. researchers said this week. A large study examining a possible association between ALS, which is the actual name of the disease, and 12 types of chemicals turned up the link, which researchers said does need to be confirmed in other studies. They found no significant link between ALS and most chemicals, including pesticides and herbicides. They found people who had been regularly exposed to formaldehyde were 34% more likely to develop the disease. We really went interested in the pesticide and herbicide question, a Harvard researcher. But the study involved more than 1,100 people enrolled in a cancer prevention study who died of ALS. Certain jobs seemed to have a much higher risk, according to the study. Beautician, pharmacist, mortician, chemist, lab technician, dentist, fireman, photographer, printer, nurse, doctor, and veterinarian. People in those jobs had about a 30% higher rate of ALS. This researcher said the finding could still just be chance, but he did find the more exposure to the chemical people reported, the more likely they were to develop the disease. But, you know, they're such nice trailers. Now, ladies and gentlemen, so much attention was devoted to the questions that George Stephanopoulos asked, particularly Barack Obama, at the presidential debate this past week. I'd like to direct a little attention to the question that George Stephanopoulos didn't ask John McCain on his Sunday morning Yak show appearance. Stephanopoulos allowed John McCain to repeat his talking points that he's pleased with the progress in Iraq, won't be too much longer, et cetera, et cetera. Did not ask him about this. Did not even mention this in that context, in that questioning. Dateline Washington. The war in Iraq has become, quote, a major debacle, unquote, and the outcome is, quote, in doubt, unquote. This, according to some left-wing crazy, some right-wing crazy, Ron Paul, Dennis Kucinich, no, the Pentagon's premier military educational institute. Pentagon, ladies and gentlemen, I think John McCain knows where it is. The National Defense University's report raises fresh doubts about President Bush's and John McCain's projections of a U.S. victory in Iraq. It carries considerable weight, says McClatchy Newspapers, whose Jonathan Landay was right, unbelievably right, all the way along before the war. Maybe he deserves, oh, I don't know, award for being right when all of his brothers and sisters weren't. Anyway, he says the report carries considerable weight because it was written by Joseph Collins, a former senior Pentagon official, and was based in part on interviews with other former senior defense and intelligence officials who played roles in pre-war preparations. It was published by the university's National Institute for Strategic Studies. Quote, measured in blood and treasure, the war in Iraq has achieved the status of a major war and a major debacle. That's the opening line of the report. At least they didn't bury the lead. No one has as yet calculated the costs of long-term veterans' benefits or the total impact on service personnel and materiel, says Collins. The U.S. has suffered serious political costs, according to the report, with its standing in the world seriously diminished. Yeah. Moreover, operations in Iraq have diverted, quote, manpower, materiel, and the attention of decision-makers from all other efforts in the war on terror, unquote. Pentagon saying it now, not John Kerry. And severely strained the U.S. armed forces. Quote, compounding all of these problems, our efforts in Iraq were designed to enhance U.S. national security, but they have become at least temporarily an incubator for terrorism and have emboldened Iran to expand its influence throughout the Middle East, unquote, the report. The surge has improved security, but not enough to ensure the country emerges as a stable democracy. Strong majorities of both Iraqis and Americans favor some sort of U.S. withdrawal. Intelligence analysts, however, remind us that the only thing worse than an Iraq with an American army may be an Iraq after a rapid withdrawal of that army. For many analysts, including this one, he writes, Iraq remains a must-win. But for many others, it now looks like a can't-win, unquote. The report lays much of the blame for what went wrong in Iraq after the initial victory at the feet of then-Defense Secretary Rumsfeld. The report says before the war in Afghanistan was over, in November 2001, President Bush asked Rumsfeld to begin planning in secret for potential military operations against Iraq. November 2001. Well, plans, you know, they all got plans. Says the report, Rumsfeld bypassed the Joint Chiefs of Staff, hello, General Myers, and became the direct supervisor of the combat commanders. The aggressive hands-on Rumsfeld, says the report, cajoled and pushed his way toward a small force and a lightning-fast operation. Later, he shut down the military's computerized deployment system, questioning, delaying, or deleting units on the numerous deployment orders that came across his desk. That's in part because long, costly, manpower-intensive post-combat operations were anathema to Rumsfeld. And that's one reason, a major reason, why the U.S. was unprepared to fight what Collins calls War B, what happened after Saddam was toppled. Compounding the problem was a series of faulty assumptions made by Bush's top aides, among them an expectation fed by Iraqi exiles that Iraqis would be grateful to America for liberating them. The administration also expected that Iraq could, without Saddam, could manage and fund its own reconstruction. The report also singles out the Bush administration's national security apparatus and implicitly President Bush and both of his national security advisors, Condi and Stephen Nepal Hadley, saying that the senior national security officials exhibited in many instances an imperious attitude, exerting power and pressure where diplomacy and bargaining might have had a better effect, unquote. Collins ends his report by quoting Winston Churchill, who said, let us learn our lessons. Never, never believe any war will be smooth and easy, or that anyone who embarks on the strange voyage can measure the tides and hurricanes he will encounter. Well, I don't care about hurricanes either. Always remember, however sure you are that you can easily win, that there would not be a war if the other man did not think that he also had a chance, end quote. Winston Churchill in the National Defense University's report on what they call a major debacle. You know Major Debacle. He reports to General Petraeus. Also of news in Iraq, this program has shared with you reports about the problem of displaced people both inside and outside Iraq and the fact that the United States, unlike Sweden, is taking minimal steps to deal with the refugee situation. Well, guess who is? Guess who's dealing with the displaced in Iraq? Not the government. According to the Washington Post, the Iraqi government has provided little financial assistance to the more than 2 million Iraqis who fled the sectarian violence and has also failed to support millions more internally displaced people Who's helping them? The dreaded militias. This, according to a report from Refugees International. Militias of all denominations are improving their local base of support by providing social services in neighborhoods and towns they control. It finds the Iraqi government, although it has access to large sums of money, I wonder where they got that, lacks the capacity and political will to address humanitarian needs. Some senior Iraqi officials are suspicious of the refugees' politics or religious leanings. So, the militias are helping. And, ladies and gentlemen, the United States commanders in Iraq have begun releasing thousands of detainees. They expect to free more than half of the 23,000 held by American forces. This is a part of a broad effort to reshape the military's controversial detention policies. Never too late for that. In part because the large number of Iraqis in U.S. custody is a source of public anger there. Imagine that. U.S. officials also believe freeing the primarily Sunni detainees will persuade the embattled minority to participate more in the political process. Well, they'll be in such a good mood after having been in U.S. detention. You know they'll want to flock to the polls just after reloading. The releases are a big test of a new U.S. initiative to determine which detainees pose long-term security risks and which can be safely released. Senior U.S. officials estimate fewer than 10,000 of the detainees will have to remain in custody. Some say the number may be as small as 2,500 out of a total of 23,000. One in 10, ladies and gentlemen, poses any danger. But, you know, round them all up, smack them around, make them happy, release them, let them vote. Good plan. What do you think? Insurgents suspected of posing security threats can be held for years without being brought to trial. The locations of U.S. prison facilities in Iraq make visits by family members difficult. The military would have to theoretically free all detainees by the end of the year when the U.S. mandate expires, unless Washington and Baghdad strike that bilateral deal. When there aren't a security risk, it's our obligation to release them, says Brigadier General Mike Nevin, who oversees the U.S. detention facilities in greater Baghdad. His quote continues, "The trick is, how do you know when they're no longer a threat?" Maybe. Maybe when they never were.
Papa, am I?
Yeah, yeah,
yeah. Ride the ball to yonder star. We'll go sailing through the sky. Like Jack and Jill, we'll get a thrill. A pedal pushing papa, am I? I'll saddle like Audrey. Bounce round like Fred Astaire. And when that trip is over, you'll know that I was there. So if you decide you want to ride, I'll gladly be your guide. Just ask for them, the love of man. A pedal pushing papa, am I?
Pedal pushing papa, is he?
That's me.
Pedal pushing papa, is he?
Yes, sir. Let the engine have a thrill.
Because a pedal pushing papa, is he?
That's me.
A pedal pushing papa,
I'll rock your soul and make you roll.
Because a pedal pushing papa is he.
I'll saddle and saddle like Audrey. Bounce round like Fred Astaire. And when that trip is over, you'll know that I was there. So if you decide you night, I'll gladly be your guide. Just ask for them, the love of man. A pale pushing papa, am I? Oh, yeah.
Pale pushing papa, am I?
This is Le Show. And now, ladies and gentlemen, time for me to read the trades for you. A couple of neat ones this week. First, from Advertising Age, is Earth Day the new Christmas? It's a provocative question.
You know what?
I'll read it for you. It's nearly Earth Day. As April 22 approaches, marketers of all stripes are bombarding consumers with green promotions and products designed to get them to buy more products. Some eco-friendly, some not so much. And while that message seems to contrast with the day's intent, the oxymoron seems to have been lost on marketers jumping on the Earth Day bandwagon in record numbers. This year, it seems just about everyone has found a way to attach themselves to what is fast becoming a marketing holiday that barely resembles the grassroots event founded in 1970. Quote, "This month I've definitely seen a lot of companies that I never would have associated with green popping up," says Stephen Addis, CEO of Addis Creason, a branding firm. Ouch! Quote, "Companies are saying, we need something to green ourselves up, so let's sponsor Earth Day. It's really now in this hype curve, and hopefully we're getting toward the top so we can start having some fallout," unquote. I think he means fallout in a good way. Not the strontium 90 way. Back to the article. Indeed, many have begun to worry that nearly every company out there paints themselves green, they are losing touch with Earth Day's reason for being. Says Larry Light, chairman of a management firm, "My concern is that some companies just view Earth Day as a marketing event, like Thanksgiving or Christmas." There's not much marketing around Thanksgiving, is there? Unless you're in the turkey business. See, what's he suggesting? The whole issue of sustainability, he says, means that a commitment also has to be sustainable. If it's only for one day, then it's a marketing event, he says. Example, Clorox is flexing its green muscles this month. Its Brita brand's integration with NBC's The Biggest Loser has resulted in the elimination of plastic water bottles from the show's campus. Says Addis of the consultant, the branding consultant. "It's great that companies are starting to do something, but what really drives me crazy is when it's used as a vehicle for greenwashing. I call it the 95-5 rule. 5% of somebody's business is green, but 95% of their PR is." There are some companies that are still feeling their way around and probably greenwashing to some extent, says Ken Rother, president and chief operating officer of the Planet Green Initiative. "This is the problem of our times, but anything that raises awareness is good," he says. The Federal Trade Commission has begun to respond to concerns. It announced in November it will begin reviewing its green marketing guides, last updated in 1998. But until it updates its guidelines, anybody can claim the mantle of green if it suits them. And if skepticism among consumers increases, one concern is they could stop paying attention altogether. That is leading some to declare Earth Day an over-commercialized event that has lost the cachet that made it so successful in the first place. Earth Day's usefulness has passed, says one. The idea we're going to direct our attention to the planet for a day or a week is not a sufficient response anymore. I'll tell you what's sufficient. Reality shows. But not sufficient, according to CBS and Mark Burnett from The Hollywood Reporter. CBS wants to queue up jingles in the summer. The network is readying a new reality show from producer Mark Burnett, where contestants compose melodies to sell products. CBS ordered 8 episodes of the advertiser-friendly Jingles, probably not the actual title when it gets on the air. Sources said the series has started casting and pre-production. CBS is expected to announce a launch within the next couple of weeks. The one-hour competition will feature contestants writing and performing product jingles before a panel of judges. The serenaded item can range from groceries to clothing to writing a theme song for a TV show. Viewers will pick the winning jingle each week, and the tune will later be used in a commercial. Burnett helped pioneer product placement in reality television with such shows as The Survivor and The Apprentice. But the entire point of jingles challenges is to better sell a product. CBS declined comment. That's the smartest thing they've done all week. A conclusion I reach, ladies and gentlemen, after I've read the traits for you. Copyrighted feature of this broadcast. And now, ladies and gentlemen, news of the warm, won't you?
Soft, listen to the warm.
Attention, Geico cavemen. In Paris, at a ministerial-level meeting of major carbon emitters, Germany mocked President Bush's new speech on global warming as, quote, Neanderthal. South Africa blasted the proposal as a disastrous retreat by the planet's number one polluter and a slap to poor countries. The German Environment Minister Sigmar Gabriel gave a speech entitled, a statement entitled, Bush's Neanderthal Speech. His speech, says the German Environment Minister, showed not leadership, but losership. Hey, at least it's a ship. Melting glaciers, disappearing ice sheets, and warming water could lift sea levels by as much as 1.5 meters by the end of the century, displacing tens of millions of people, according to New Scientist. That's the conclusion of a new prediction of sea level rises that for the first time takes into account ice dynamics. Hey, that should be in the Olympics, shouldn't it? Ice dynamics. Svetlana Jevrejeva of the laboratory in the UK says a new, more accurate reconstruction of sea levels over the past 2,000 years suggests that the prediction of an 18 to 59 centimeter rise by 2100 made by the UN Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change is wildly inaccurate. They are, he says, understatements. But there's good news, ladies and gentlemen. What does a coral reef look like 80 years after being nuked? Not so bad. Coconuts growing on Bikini Atoll, they haven't fared so well, however. The three islands of the atoll were vaporized by the Bravo hydrogen bomb in 1954. Instead of finding a bare underwater moonscape, ecologists who've dived have given it a clean bill of health. It was fascinating. I've never seen corals growing like trees outside the Marshall Islands, says one. The colleagues report a thriving ecosystem of 183 species of coral, some of which were 8 meters high. They estimate the diversity of species represents about 65% of what was there before the atomic tests. The lack of human disturbance is helping the recovery. Ambient radiation is low, but people have remained at bay. The reef is almost completely undisturbed to this day, says an Australian researcher, Maria Beger. She did take a Geiger counter with her on dives and says the background levels were similar to that in any Australian city. The same could not be said of coconuts growing on the islands. When I put the Geiger counter near a coconut, which accumulates radioactive material from the soil, it went berserk. But now we know how to save the coral reefs. Nuke them. Extreme, you say? I plead guilty. Now, the apologies of the week.
We're so sorry.
Extremism in the pursuit of nuking. Deadline Washington. At that meeting where the Pope met with a handful of victims in the pedophile priest scandal, the pontiff apologized to his guests for not being fluent in English. And, according to another victim, quote, for everything, unquote. U.S. television news network CNN News said it did not mean to cause offense when one of its commentators said the Chinese were goons and their products were junk. It was not Jack Cafferty's nor CNN's intent to cause offense to the Chinese people, and CNN would apologize to anyone who has interpreted the comments in this way, CNN says. Paris Hilton, who has apologized to former pal Kim Kardashian, who? Oh, a daughter of OJ's pal, Bob. After poking fun at the reality TV star's famous bottom live on air in a recent radio interview, Hilton insisted she'd never swap butts with the voluptuous former Playboy pinup. Ugh. I can't even read any more of that. And it comes from Star Pulse, which raises the question, which one of them is a star? Senator Barack Obama quickly corrected a slip-up about his name at the Associated Press luncheon in Washington, D.C. this week. Dean Singleton, board chairman of the Associated Press, a longtime newspaper executive who's denuded community newspapers across California, asked Obama about the possibility of shifting troops into Afghanistan. Quote, can you imagine shifting a substantial number of Afghanistan, a substantial number to Afghanistan, where the Taliban has been gaining strength and Obama bin Laden is still at large? Singleton asked. Obama, clearly a bit agitated, quickly interrupted him. I think that was Osama bin Laden, the Democrat candidate said, and then took a big gulp of water. Singleton quickly apologized. No, not for denuding his newspapers across California. Quote, if I did that, I'm so sorry, he said. The apologies of the week, ladies and gentlemen. Oh, no, one more. Sorry. Also to Obama. A Republican congressman has apologized to Barack Obama after referring to the White House hopeful as, quote, a snake oil salesman and a, quote, boy, unquote. In a letter, Kentucky Representative Jeff Davis said his poor choice of words is regrettable and was in no way meant to impugn you or your integrity. I offer my sincere apology to you and ask for your forgiveness. My comment in no way reflects the personal and professional respect I have for you. The apologies of the week, ladies and gentlemen, a copyrighted feature of this broadcast. Sorry, sorry, sorry. What's Mushy up to? Pakistan President Pervez Musharraf has condemned attempts from the West to undermine the Beijing Olympics. He described China as a typical example of development and progress and denounced the West for trying to impose their own ideas of human rights. The error that the West and the Western media makes, this does not work at all and this must stop. Why would he be saying that? Dateline Beijing, China has expressed its full readiness to assist Pakistan for the development of energy, mineral, and mining sectors, extend financial cooperation, and upgrade communication and transportation links. Yes, Master. And the GAO reports that the United States never has had a plan to destroy terrorist threats and close the safe havens in Pakistan's territories. The United States has not met its national security goals to do that, says the Government Accountability Office. That's because of the grown-ups in charge. Ladies and gentlemen, that concludes this production-free edition of Le Show. The program returns next week at the same time over these same stations over NPR worldwide throughout Europe on the UFSN 440 cable system in Japan, around the world through the facilities of the American Forces Network, up and down the east coast of North America via the shortwave giant WBCQ, the planet 7.41 megahertz. Shortwave! Think of it. On the mighty 104 in Berlin, on Sirius and XM satellite radio, quick before they merge. Available as a free podcast at kcrw.com. Available as a free download at the audible.com/LeShow. And available around the world via the internet at two different locations, harryshearer.com and kcrw.com, live and archived. Check out where we stream at www.publicradiofan.com. And it would be just like somebody in the media paying attention to the first time in United States history that high government leaders authorized procedures tantamount to torture. If you'd agree to join with me then, would you already? Thank you very much. Uh-huh. A tip of the Le Show chapeau to the San Diego, Pittsburgh, and Chicago desks, and to Jenny Lawson here at WWNO-FM in New Orleans for making today's program possible. Playlists and email address for the host of the broadcast available at the always evolving harryshearer.com. No, it's not evolving. It was created. How about that Chris Paul? The show comes to you from Century of Progress Productions and originates through the facilities of KCRW Santa Monica, a community recognized around the world as the home of the homeless. There is no K, O, or B in team. So long from New Orleans.